Well, it is our pleasure to have you, Dr. Pimentel. What a treat. And thank you. I know you're very busy, so it's an honor and a privilege that we so greatly appreciate. We are going to be moving at a breakneck speed, basically, so we can cover as many questions as possible. And just so everybody knows, Dr. Pimentel has graciously agreed to come back to SIBO SOS Speaker Series and join us on July 12th. So be sure to mark your calendars. Also, he will be making lots of announcements in June, so that's why we have him also in July, which we'll touch on briefly during our time, because he's going to be announcing that at Digestive Disease Week in Washington, D.C. One thing I wanted to ask you, Dr. Pimentel, that's a very consistent question is, if someone wanted to come see one of your colleagues at Cedars-Sinai, how could they do that?
So the only rule we have is that we're not primary care. So what we can't accommodate is people who use us as their primary GI 24/7 coverage, because we don't take call that way. We're sort of quaternary care. So as long as you have a gastroenterologist that you can rely on, for the off hour coverage, we can take those referrals. And you can be referred from anybody, but as long as you have a primary gastroenterologist, that would be great.
And so when you say anybody, could a naturopath refer?
Yes, as long as the gastroenterologist was also in the mix, then, because we want to make sure that if you had a sudden event in the middle of the night, we don't have those kind of call setups, and we have to have that backup.
Okay, super. Simple. All right, good to know. Good to know. So Maxine is here. Guys, you can definitely pop into the Q&A box and say hello, and I always love to hear from where you are from today and what you've been up to in terms of your excitement for the event. And we're going to be doing a lot of exciting things over the next couple of months. We have Dr. Alana Gervitz and Gary Stapleton of Aerodiagnostics, who's going to be doing a double whammy day April 21st. So watch your emails for that. We have people joining us, Dr. Pimentel, from Switzerland, Arizona, Philadelphia, Sparks, Nevada, Scottsdale. I know we have someone from South Africa also who's joining us. People from all over the world, Netherlands, Australia, New Zealand, India. Super cool. And of course, the good old USA, Switzerland again, Rhode Island. Shalom, Dr. Zieger. Okay. I'm glad everybody's here. We're going to get started. I'm going to grab the questions and we are going to get are learning on. Let me find it. And as always, I like to say, please don't think I'm being rude when I move along very quickly after one of the questions has been answered. I just want to make sure we can get as many as possible. And out of respect for everyone who's here, I'm going to give you guys, and who's jamming to get in here, I'm going to give you guys that 2 more minutes. Dr. Pimentel, in terms of Digestive Disease Week, I know you'll be tweeting. How else can we learn about what you're going to be announcing there?
Well, we have a lot of big presentations at the Digestive Disease Week, and we're very excited about that, because some of the new things that we're going to be presenting will be very impactful and make a difference. So we're making a big leap forward. But yes, I will be tweeting, so that will be part of it. Obviously, that's shallow information. It's only a small number of characters. But we'll do our best to, there'll be probably some press releases related to some of the discoveries. But also, I'll be at the SIBO Symposium in Oregon. So that's another way I can share that information, because I think that's the week, exactly the week after. So that might be my first presentation to the public on new stuff. So
that's going to be great. That's going to be great. I will see you there as well. And then you'll be with us on July 12th. So thank you so much. Looking forward to that. Okay, everybody, if you're having any technical problems, Karen is standing by. Cindy's with us for the first half hour. Remember, you can always email us at info@sibosos.com. That's info@sibosos.com. And we are off. So first question, Dr. Pimentel. I'm going to save one of the doozies for later. So right now, I want to get patients' questions answered. If I get food poisoning, what should I do to not get SIBO afterwards? Should I take antibiotics? B, what if I don't know if it's viral or bacterial food poisoning? What are your thoughts on that?
So we know that food poisoning causes IBS. That's now absolutely clear cut. The paper by the Mayo Clinic last year, 45 studies combined, shows absolutely for sure SIBO, IBS are caused by food poisoning. But the question you're asking is, what if I have food poisoning right now? What can I do? And the answer to that is we don't know. There isn't a study that says once you get food poisoning, if you treat it with antibiotics, it will avert the development of IBS. But we have indirect evidence that that might be the case. For example, if your food poisoning is 2 days in duration, you're much less likely to get IBS than if it's 1 week in duration. So if the antibiotics can cut the time down and the exposure time down, we think it will reduce the rate. It won't go to zero, but it will reduce the rate. I'll just give you one final snippet, is that in our study, in animal studies, we showed that if you got antibiotics during food poisoning, meaning as prevention, so if you were to travel to an area that you knew that there was a high rate and you took antibiotics with each and every meal, you would never get food poisoning and you would never get IBS or SIBO. And so that's a big, you know, big thing, because if you're traveling to those areas that are very problematic, underserviced, underdeveloped countries, you can rest assured you would not get IBS or SIBO if you took prophylaxis.
So when we're talking about that kind of prevention, other than rifaximin, what's another antibiotic that we could reach out to our primary care physician for? Or is there any herbal that you think might do the trick?
Well, the studies are on rifaximin, but, you know, Pepto-Bismol and other herbal preparations have been used. Even probiotics have been used to prevent food poisoning in underdeveloped areas. But their reliability in terms of preventing IBS has never been studied. So the only thing that's been studied is rifaximin in terms of preventing SIBO or IBS.
And is it the same? What's the milligrams that we should ask for?
So for prevention, 200 milligram tablet or half of a 550 is what I do when I travel to those areas of the world. So that's what I recommend. Now, of course, that's not FDA approved. So you can't, you know, it's not a typical FDA approval. You're using it off label for those purposes. But I know, if I have my facts correct, that during the earthquake and tsunami, there were a number of reporters who went, when they went there, were prophylactically taking antibiotics to prevent gastroenteritis because the water supply was all contaminated by the tsunami.
That makes sense. Which leads me to my disclaimer I didn't say in the beginning. This is not personal medical advice, everybody. Before you take any medical actions, be sure to speak to your personal physician as they are in touch with your case. So please know that this is excellent ideas and thoughts that you can share with your health team. So thank you very much for that. Let's say there are people here, they don't have an ileocecal valve, or they have, you know, this scenario in their body where they really feel like, or they've been told that you're probably going to have SIBO forever. Would this be something that they could do as well when they eat? Could they add, you know, an antibiotic to their food on a daily basis? And then I have a follow-up for that.
The problem with using antibiotics chronically, doesn't matter, you know, rifaximin is extraordinarily safe and has been used chronically for encephalopathy under the FDA approval for years in some patients with bad liver disease. But still, I mean, the optimal is not to be on antibiotics, any antibiotics for a long period of time, unless you absolutely have to. Now, I do have patients where they have SIBO, they have an explanation for SIBO that cannot be rectified, whether it's an adhesion or ileocecal valve distortion, that they require some maintenance. And, you know, what we try to do, and again, this is an off-label use, but what we try to do is reduce the dose to the lowest possible dose. I have some patients who are on half a rifaximin every 5 days, and that's enough to keep it away. So there's ways to strategize to minimize the antibiotic exposure. Or you could try alternatives, and of course, you know, there's herbal antibiotics and prokinetics that can also keep the bacteria out, and so there's a lot of strategies that can be used.
And so people are asking about the long-term use, the multiple rounds of rifaximin, 6-7 rounds, and some of them get results, some of them don't, but they're not giving up. Have you found that there is a rate of diminishing return with multiple rounds, or have you found, or has it been studied that, like, you know, maybe you should cut it off at five?
Well, let me start by saying one of the new studies that we just finished, we showed that rifaximin has about a 30% of patients who respond to rifaximin are almost one and done. So, for example, in my clinic just this last, just before I left, the week I had no voice, let's put it that way. The week I had no voice, I had a patient, and I hadn't seen her in 5 years. She was fine. She took rifaximin that one time 5 years ago, and she had not had a recurrence until now. And I have hundreds and hundreds of patients like that where I see them at the mall, not in the clinic. And the importance of saying that is that some patients are almost one and done, or I don't see them for a very, very long time. It's the patients who need it again and again. And so we had to study that, and we've studied it up to six treatments and showed that there was no diminished return up to six treatments. So in other words, if you responded the first time, you responded almost equally well the sixth time. Sometimes you took the dose and you got 6 months of benefit. Sometimes you took the dose and you got 2 months of benefit. Maybe there was diet, other things that were making one time longer than the other. Then you took it again and it was 6 months again. And so there was no predictable pattern to suggest resistance.
So for anybody who's just kind of beginning with their SIBO treatment and figuring it all out, I should have started with this, but I was so anxious. Let's do a quick definition of what post-infectious IBS is and how it could possibly lead to SIBO.
So this is work we've done for about 20 years of trying to figure out the pattern of how this happens. And what we know is that food poisoning has a particular toxin in it that then leads to changes through autoimmunity to the enteric nervous system. Then the gut doesn't flow correctly because the nerves are not connected. It's like the wires in the wall of your house are almost touching the light switch, but they're not. And so you can't get the lights on, or you can't make the gut move in a coordinated fashion. And as the small bowel is a fast-moving, fast-flowing stream, when it's not moving fast, it starts to accumulate bacteria because it's all this warm, yummy food for bacteria. And they'll grow on it very quickly. And so the weeds start to grow in the garden, as I say. And that's how, and then when the bacteria accumulate, they create symptoms, and we characterize that as irritable bowel syndrome.
Okay. When in this whole protocol of all the different SIBO treatments, do you recommend probiotics? Before, during, after, at all?
Yeah, so the problem with the probiotic story is, there are, if you, as you go to the GNC or to your Walgreens, you'll see that there's a host of probiotics. But the problem is there isn't a host of studies to show that all these probiotics work, except they say for digestive health. I am not knocking probiotics. I'm not against probiotics. What I'm against is saying it does something and you don't have data. So I would love more data. If you focus just on the irritable bowel syndrome side, IBS is either made worse or not better in most cases with probiotics based on double-blind studies. Now, there is a handful of studies that are suggesting benefit. So Align GI, which is the probiotic from Procter & Gamble, was shown in a large clinical trial, a double-blind, that it had some benefit in 1 out of 12 time points. But they published it, and it had, you know, made an impact on how much they sold. But the point I'm trying to get at is that there are data to suggest there may be benefits, but there are also data that suggest there may be bad things that happen. I recently posted on Twitter that a probiotic cocktail that was being used was actually driving methane production higher. And the patients were getting constipated, and the methane was getting to the point where it was causing trouble. So I think what we need to do is understand what works, study it, prove it, and then find better utility for it. So I hardly ever use probiotics.
Okay, and fermented food? Kombucha that's taking over the world these days?
So I don't have a problem with fermented food. I just don't know that it's going to be beneficial. The problem with fermented food is often it is things that are not on the list of good diet maintenance of SIBO. So I would generally shy away from it only because it seems like it would be a bad thing.
And then how about prebiotics?
So prebiotics is the same thing. A lot of prebiotics are fermentables. And what we try to do is not feed the bacteria of the gut, try to starve them to clear the small bowel of bacteria. Remember, the small bowel is an organ that receives all this fresh material. It's the food that makes you who you are, not leftovers. So humans are very good at extracting the nutrients. But if you now expose probiotics or good bacteria, if you want to call them that, to fresh food, they're going to proliferate. And when they proliferate, they produce gas. And when they produce gas, they make you bloated. So it doesn't matter what bacteria, if you're accumulating bacteria in the small intestine where fresh food is, you're going to have potentially more trouble. I'll say one more thing, though. We do know that bifidobacteria can have prokinetic action. So there are some who argue that bifido, and even one study maybe with lactobacillus, that certain strains can have prokinetic, meaning making the gut move, actions. And so I've always held hope that someday somebody does a study that proves that that will work for SIBO, but so far I haven't seen it.
So are there alternative tests that you could recommend since the IBS check is no longer available? Or what's the future of this kind of testing that you've developed?
So this testing is reemerging. It's going to reemerge this year. So it will be available. It will be available in its original proper form that has been validated in the PLOS-1 trial. The good news about that test is that it tells you that food poisoning caused your IBS or SIBO. The second thing, it tells you that if you were to get food poisoning again, it's going to make it worse. So it tells you that when you travel, you need to be much more careful than somebody without the antibodies. But even more importantly, we think it's going to predict new drug therapies that we're actually working on right now. So if you have those antibodies and we can get rid of them, this will go away. So all of this takes time and work, but we're heading in that direction.
Okay, so of course, as a SIBO patient, I'm going to follow up with, so when does Santa come? Is it like 2019, 2020, you think?
You know, if it was under my control, Santa would have been here a long time ago. Yeah. But it's a complicated process of getting companies that do this professionally to do it correctly and to properly bring it to the market. And it's not, if it was me, I'd be selling it out of my garage, but you can't do that because right. Then I could have done it years or months ago. It's a complicated thing.
So maybe within the next 5 years?
Sorry?
Maybe within the next 5 years?
The blood test or the treatment?
Both. Well, the blood test is happening this year, right?
This year. The treatment, I'm hoping in the next 3 years we'll have some exciting news.
Oh, sounds great. Okay. What are the implications? Okay, what are the implications and prognosis of having antibodies from a past gut infection showing up on the IBS check test for positive anti-CDTB, but not a positive result for anti-vinculin?
So the anti-CDTB or the anti-vinculin positive suggests that you have IBS. It's used as an IBS-D test. Why some people don't develop the vinculin is still a bit of a mystery, but the bad news, good news, bad news, if you're positive for anti-vinculin, we have noticed that you're more difficult to treat and sicker. So if I were a patient, I wouldn't mind having the anti-CDTB to get the diagnosis, but the anti-vinculin makes it harder. So patients come to my office, honestly, these are true stories from if they're anti-vinculin positive, they're so excited. They say, now I know I have this. And I said, yeah, but it's harder to treat. So I don't know what you want to wish for, but you know, we're trying to find the cure to it. We're trying to find something that will treat the anti-vinculin antibodies. We think we know how to do it. We're working on it right now. But hopefully it will work. You know, it's something we have to keep working on over the next 2 or 3 years. And maybe we'll have the answer and maybe we'll be able to cure this.
How many times do you see SIFO, small intestinal fungal overgrowth, combined with SIBO, and which would you treat first?
SIFO is more complicated because we don't have a good diagnostic test short of aspiration from the small bowel. And so that's what makes SIFO difficult. Now, I do believe there is some SIFO. The thing that confuses me, though, is if SIFO is so common, and I'm not saying it's common, but if it was really common, then antibiotics would make it worse because that's what antibiotics do. One of the side effects of antibiotics can be fungus in the mouth, fungus in the esophagus, and we don't see that. And we also don't see worsening of symptoms with antibiotics. More than 90% of the time, it's not worsening. It's either better or it doesn't work. So in a small handful of patients or a small percentage, we do see something that would suggest that it's SIFO. Now, Dr. Rao has a different opinion. He does, I don't know if those of you on this webcast know Dr. Satish Rao from Georgia, but he does aspirates and he's finding SIFO, again, in a relatively small percentage of patients, and he's having some good success with treatment. So the next question is, have I ever tried SIFO treatment? And the answer is yes. And in some patients, they do respond very well. But I can't say patient walks in my office and after some questions, I know who's who. So it takes some time to sort out.
When it comes to, so it's hard to prove that you have SIFO. And if you do, is there any time that you would treat it before the SIBO?
So I've never done it that way. I always go the other way around because there's a lot more data on SIBO and IBS than there is on SIFO. But if they're failing to respond and they continue to have bloating and distension, all the symptoms, and there's no obvious explanation, then I will try to treat it as SIBO.
So that leads me to a question that I saw multiple times on the submissions of questions, which is this. I've done treatments, whether it's rifaximin or it's herbal antibiotics, and I did a breath test again, and lo and behold, it's negative, but I still have bloating or I still have other symptoms. What do you say to a patient who is facing that?
Well, so remember, there's a fourth gas, hydrogen sulfide, and I know those are some questions that are coming up these days because we had a teaser abstract last year. Hydrogen sulfide is a gas we can't measure on conventional breath testing. And so if you don't measure that gas, you can't see the whole story. And that's all I'll say for that. But having a negative breath test conventionally doesn't mean you're negative. And hydrogen sulfide is critical to knowing exactly what's going on.
So for anyone who does seem to have hydrogen sulfide, that was people interpret like a straight line on the test as that's probably right. Being that?
Correct.
And what is it that you don't want to talk about right now, which is like how to treat that?
I can't tell you.
Okay. Am I ever going to learn?
We'll know it in DDW in June when we present. You'll know all that information. And then I think you'll be delighted to know some of that information. So it's a good
something to look forward to, like Christmas.
July 12th.
Oh, July? I thought July 12th. You're coming back to SIBO SOS. That's
exactly.
Right. Thank you. Thank you. I have my calendars under my pillow. I'm looking at it every night. But and you'll be announcing it at DDW first week in June.
Yes.
Okay. When it comes to methanogens, here's a good one. This is from one of your colleagues who is joining us today. What's a bloom? How should we be thinking about these blooms? And what's a bloom versus like an overgrowth, or is it the same thing?
Well, so we use the word bloom for methanogens because we're actually, when we study the stool microbiota for SIBO of hydrogen origin, we don't see much difference between somebody who's sick and somebody who's not sick. So what's happening there is we're seeing E. coli, Klebsiella growing in the small bowel, and that small bowel overgrowth. They don't belong there. When it comes to methanogens, what we're seeing is that the methanogens in the stool are higher than they ought to be. And that higher number correlates with what we're seeing on the breath test. So what we're assuming is that in stool, and maybe other parts of the gut, maybe in the small bowel as well, that methanogens are overabundant. So basically, they're blooming, you could say, and that's a term we've used in some of my talks as well. So the methanogen bloom is abnormal. So bacteria can be in the wrong place or with the wrong proportion or number, and the proportion or number means bloom.
Okay. How do you test for the migrating motor complex? And maybe if somebody's new, you want to, do you have like a quick way of explaining what that is?
Sure. So if you haven't eaten in the morning and you wake up and you have this grumbling sound in your stomach and you're embarrassed and you're on the bus or you're sitting in a classroom and your person next to you is looking at you like your stomach is making all these sounds, that's a good thing. That's the cleaning wave coming through. It lasts about 10 minutes, starts in the stomach actually, and goes all the way through the small bowel, stripping out all the junk from last night's meal that you couldn't digest and sweeping it into the colon. And that occurs, that sound occurs because of the migrating motor complex or housekeeper wave, we call it. So it's like your dishwasher cleans up. And then it'll go away for about 90 minutes, and then it will come back. And then we'll go away for 90 minutes and come back again. All through the night when you're not eating, this cleaning wave is cleaning you up, getting ready for breakfast. But when you don't have that cleaning wave, the debris, the yucky stuff from the meal last night sits in the small bowel and doesn't get cleaned out, and then the bacteria start to grow on that. And we think, we don't think, because in 1976, Van Trappen proved that if you don't have this wave, you get overgrowth. If you take narcotics, which inhibit this wave, you get overgrowth. And so anything that inhibits this wave or any disease that causes this wave to be less, you get overgrowth. And so that's, now the question you had was, how do you measure it? So the problem with measuring the migrating motor complex is there's only one way currently, and that's invasive. So we have to put a tube through your nose, all the way down through the into the stomach, through the stomach, into the small intestine. You have to guarantee that it's there under an X-ray kind of guidance. And then for 6 hours, we measure the waves and see how many you have, how strong are they, how long do they last, and look at all the morphology of it.
And what is that test called?
It's called a enteroduodenal manometry.
And do they hand those out like lollipops?
You know, there's probably, I would say, 6 or 8 places in the country that still do it. And in California, 2 places only.
So is it the kind of thing where if you really do get a script from your gastroenterologist that you could have one of these tests? Is it like,
if you really wanted to know that the migrating motor complex was a problem, you could get this test. Again, we don't do it as often as we used to because we've shown that approximately 80% of patients with SIBO, the migrating motor complex is the problem. So it's better than Vegas that your migrating motor complex isn't working so well in most cases. But we still do it. We still do a couple of months because we find the circumstance where it would be more helpful than not to do it.
Which leads us to meal spacing. So can you explain how meal spacing is helpful for preventing relapse of SIBO and why it's important? And everybody's talking about intermittent fasting these days. What do you think about that versus just meal spacing? Or is meal spacing really intermittent fasting and you were fashionable before everybody else?
So the migrating motor comes. So the small intestine is designed to have eating mode and cleaning mode. Cleaning mode when you're not eating. So humans are designed to have periods of fasting because that allows these cleaning waves to start moving through. So if you have 10 cleaning waves a day, which is a normal person, then you're fine. You don't get SIBO, everything's fine. But if you're a SIBO patient, and maybe you're lucky if you have 2 a day, you want to make it more, or you want to make sure those 2 come and you don't get in the way. So let me give you an example. So you need, when you eat a meal, it completely shuts down cleaning waves, like immediately. In fact, as you're sitting at the table, the cleaning waves are already shutting down because you're going into what we call cephalic phase of eating, because your mind is saying, okay, I'm just about to eat. Let's start producing digestive juices. Let's start getting the motor going for digestion. And as soon as you put food in your mouth and you start swallowing it, you're not going to have cleaning waves anymore for about 2 hours. So you will not see any cleaning waves coming during it. Because if you had a cleaning wave during a meal, imagine you're forcing all that food into the colon in 10 minutes. So the cleaning wave will be very dramatic to the meal. It will get rid of it. So you can't have cleaning waves. So the gut turns into eating mode. But even if you had a candy with sugar in it, you shut off the cleaning waves, maybe not for 2 hours, but you shut it off for 40 minutes, 50 minutes. So people who sit at desk jobs and they're working and they have a dish of candy in front of them and they're just popping a candy every couple of hours or something like that. They're shutting down their cleaning waves constantly. So between the candies and the breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then your coffee latte with milk in it or whatever, you could have no cleaning waves all day. And that may be okay for somebody who doesn't have a SIBO tendency, but if you have SIBO tendencies, you want to have fasting periods as much as possible.
So a mint, no good. It will disrupt that cleaning wave. But what about water?
So water is non-nutrients. So if you talk about nutrients, so we think coffee does not. Tea without anything in it does not. Water does not abort the cleaning waves. But anything with a calorie or a calorie trigger. So, for example, some of the substitute sugars can bind to receptors in the gut, indicating that there's a meal even if they don't get absorbed, like stevia and those types of things. So even those items can trigger or stop the cleaning wave.
What if someone has low blood sugar?
Yeah, so low blood sugar, you have no choice. You have to respond to it. You have no choice. You have to take some sugar.
And you just mentioned dairy. And I know that when we spoke, when I was interviewing you for the next summit, you were talking about how you don't feel that folks with SIBO tendencies should really be doing dairy.
So the more specific answer is yes, dairy and the lactose in dairy is a carbohydrate that it's difficult for humans to digest. So an average adult human can tolerate a glass of milk without any lactose getting to the colon. But two glasses of milk and some lactose will spill over into the colon, even in a normal human without SIBO. But one glass of milk requires the entire 15 feet of small bowel to absorb all the lactose because your enzyme is very relatively deficient as an adult, the lactase enzyme. So if you had SIBO, basically you're giving amazing sugar, easy to digest, to the whole 15 feet of small bowel before you absorb it. Now, contrast that to glucose. Glucose gets absorbed within the first 2 or 3 feet. You're grabbing glucose like crazy. So the bacteria hardly have a chance to take it in because you're grabbing it so quickly. Sucrose is the same thing. You're grabbing it extremely. So the white granulated sugar, you pick it up really quick before it ever gets to bacteria. But lactose, it just lingers too long and is symptomatic. But if you did lactose-free milk, you'd be fine. And there are people in my clinic who are diehard cheese fans, and they resist me. But the older the cheese, the harder the cheese, the less lactose it has in it. So, for example, Parmesan, Asiago cheese, super aged cheddars usually have almost no lactose in it, and probably you can get away with it.
Okay. When it comes to retesting, we're switching gears a little bit here. So I've done my rifaximin or I've done my antimicrobials and I want to retest to see how I did. What's the window that you see as being the best idea for that?
So if you have a response to antibiotics, that's 80%. So I'm 80% better as a result of antibiotics. You don't need to retest because it's hard to get better than 80% with anything for SIBO. So I tend to tell patients that if you want to retest and you're motivated to retest, then go ahead. But I, rather than waste healthcare dollars and your money, I would say just you're done. But if you have a partial response or a 30% response and you don't know what's going on, those are the patients I retest. The other group I tend to be more likely to retest is methane positive, because if you're methane positive, it's really important to get that methane to zero to get the best effect. And we do think, and this is not yet published and not even being presented yet, but we do think that if your methane doesn't quite get down to below that 5 or 3, that your chance of recurring or relapsing with methane is much higher. And so we think it can predict relapse.
So if somebody has that, what's your advice for them to be thinking about? Is this just like a way of life? Is this just going to be like something I have to deal with because that's the kind of numbers I have for periodically for the rest of my life? And it's just a lifestyle change, a chronic condition that I need to manage? or do you think maybe with some of the new announcements or whatever, we could resolve it? Like, can we ever cure?
So my goal is that in 5 to 10 years, we don't treat this with antibiotics anymore, that we treat the root cause. Antibiotics are, remember, the idea of SIBO. SIBO is not a diagnosis. It's caused by the migrating motor complex deficiency. If we can fix that, then we don't need antibiotics. If we can fix the vinculin antibodies, then we don't need to fix the migrating motor complex. It will fix itself. And so we need to fix the root, not trim the trees. What we're doing right now is trimming the tree with antibiotics. We're not really dealing with the big problem.
So in terms of finding an underlying cause, let's say somebody had an IBS check test and they didn't have those antibodies and they have SIBO, and we realize SIBO is a result of something else. Do you have any strategies that you can share with everyone about what are some, what's an approach, like a domino effect that we can participate in to find an underlying cause? Do you have anything that you always test first, three things, or?
Well, so I know, let me say it another way, and I've expressed this before. One of the things that's most frustrating is the number of diagnostic tests patients with SIBO undergo, the years of suffering, the years of seeing physicians without getting identified, even some physicians still saying they don't know what this is or they don't believe this is something. I understand all of that, and it's extraordinarily frustrating how much patients have paid out of pocket to get to the final answer. And so my goal is not to keep adding dollars to people. So if you respond to rifaximin or an herbal antibiotic or some antibiotic and you're doing great, then getting to the bottom of it isn't so important, because as I say, 80% of patients, it's the migrating motor complex. It's the patient where they're relapsing really quickly that it's important to get to the bottom of it. Because, for example, there have been patients where they come into my office and they have SIBO, no doubt, but it turns out that it was a cancer in the small bowel that was causing a blockage. I don't want to put the fear of God into patients that everybody needs to check for cancer of the bowel, because if you had cancer of the bowel and you took an antibiotic and you got better and it came back in a week, then you have to start thinking about things that are causing the SIBO. If it comes back in a year, the SIBO, then you don't have anything like that, because a blockage would present itself really quickly. So, and cancer of the small bowel, by the way, is extremely rare. It's so rare. We maybe see one cancer in 10 years of the small bowel in my clinic. So I wouldn't, but adhesions we see more commonly. And adhesions can cause SIBO, but again, it would come back within a week or 2 weeks after the antibiotics, after you felt better for that period of time. So there are indicators that tell us when we should, you know, go more aggressively to figure it out.
When it comes to the drug Alinia, there's some interest in Alinia with rifaximin. What's your take on Alinia?
So Alinia, nitazoxanide, is a drug that's similar to Flagyl or metronidazole. And you could argue that it has similar characteristics. We use rifaximin, for example, with neomycin for methane. As an alternative, we use rifaximin and metronidazole for methane. We found that that's effective. So the rifaximin and neomycin is a double-blind study published. Rifaximin plus metronidazole, only experiential data. So I don't have a published paper, although in experience we see that it works really great for methane. I don't have a lot of data combining with Alinia, mostly because you're combining one expensive drug with another expensive drug, and that's the biggest hurdle, in my opinion, for using Alinia.
Neomycin. So we have a couple of people in the group that have hearing loss, and what is it called? Tinnitus? I never pronounce that right.
Tinnitus.
Is neomycin absolutely off limits for those folks?
So if you have kidney dysfunction or you have hearing dysfunction, then I would say no neomycin. But to put a caveat around that, the reason that claim is in there is for a couple of reasons. Neomycin is in the same family as gentamicin. Gentamicin is a non-absorbed antibiotic. It's only used intravenously. So back in the day when people used to get heart valve infections, gentamicin used to be critically important to take intravenously to help get rid of the heart valve infection. And so you had to take gentamicin for 3 months intravenously. And they noticed that people's hearing diminished on gentamicin. Neomycin, because it's exactly the same class of drug, got that label. It had to be on the label because it's the same class of drug. But neomycin is oral, doesn't get absorbed. So I have never seen tinnitus or hearing loss from neomycin in any clinical trial or in any clinical practice that we have done. The interesting story that I'll tell you is that there was a patient in the double-blind randomized control trial of rifaximin and neomycin. First patient in the trial, the FDA required us to tell people about the ear changes, and we had to do ear testing before, and if anybody complained of anything, we had to do it again. First patient in the study says, my hearing is going. And because they read it in the brochure we gave them. So sure enough, we stopped the drugs. We test their hearing a second time. In the meanwhile, the patient developed a very bad cold. And so it was probably the beginnings of the cold. And then after they stopped the drugs, they fell out of the trial. We did their hearing again, and it was better than the first time. So it's people know about it, but we really don't see a negative effect that way. So, but again, back to the question, if you have hearing problems, I probably wouldn't recommend it and it would be contraindicated.
I know some people feel like they're at their last resort and that was like the one thing they hadn't done. So they're very interested in that, of course. Do you see a lot of success with the elemental diet in your practice?
So we're the ones who started this whole elemental diet pathway because it was an interesting story because there was a patient of mine who was struggling. We got rid of their bacterial overgrowth. This was pre-rifaximin in the neomycin only days, and we got rid of their overgrowth once. They were brilliantly improved, and then we could never treat it again. They got resistance, and that's why we really were pushing toward rifaximin, which doesn't develop resistance, because we were seeing so much resistance back then. And because of all that resistance, we were moving towards the elemental diet. And so we knew that Vivanex, which is one of the elemental formulas, was used in the 1970s before going for a surgery on the colon to try and reduce bacteria. And so we said, well, let's try this for SIBO. And sure enough, that first patient, it was brilliant. The patient was fine for months after. And that's how it all started, with that one patient. But we've done probably 3,000 patients with elemental diet. We've been doing it less now because the antibiotics have been more successful with less resistance. But we still do it.
So if someone has hearing issues, can't do neomycin, certainly look at the elemental diet as a possibility.
Yes. The problem with the elemental diet is taste. They get a little weight loss because they feel very, they might be tired on it, or they're not taking enough of it because they don't like the flavor. And so those are the things that make it challenging. And it's 2 full weeks, no cheating, no coffee, no tea. It's just water and elemental diet for 2 full weeks. And I always tell my patients there's 3 stages of the elemental diet. The first 3 days, where they feel like they're starving because they aren't chewing on food. The middle time where they feel okay, they're getting used to it. And the last 3 days where they put up a picture of my face on their wall and throw darts at it because of what I put them through. So it's tough. It's not easy to do 14 days.
Speaking of which, and underweight, and I have to ask you this, there are so many people who are really dealing with a serious issue, which is if you are underweight, you cannot keep that weight on. And they may have SIBO, certainly digestive issues. What do you do for folks like that?
So are you suggesting that they're not responsive to the therapy, first of all, or?
I think that a lot of them it's everything. They're underweight. They can't keep the weight on. They've done some treatment and maybe their SIBO is clear, but they still keep losing the weight. Some of them are dealing with diarrhea and they can't keep the weight on. There just seems to be this group of people who are really struggling to maintain body mass.
Yeah. So in those instances, there's a lot of things we do. So, for example, there was a patient that I had who had SIBO classic, everything SIBO, but again, low body weight. And we tried to the elemental diet, that worked, but only temporarily. We tried antibiotics and so forth and so on. So, and it turns out that on CT, she had an atrophic pancreas. So her pancreas was maybe 10 to 15% the size of what it normally should be. So she couldn't produce enough enzymes. So we treated her for overgrowth, put her on pancreatic enzymes, and she did well. The patients with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome who develop SIBO have a great tendency to lose weight. And we don't understand that entirely, but looking for Ehlers-Danlos. My point is there's, you know, a list of about 40 different things that we start to sort of shuffle through as we see patients who have profound weight loss or difficulty maintaining weight and they're at a low body weight. And we have to make sure that we exclude some of these disorders that that we're noticing.
When it comes to enzymes, people have a lot of questions about enzymes. Can you take too many? Do you take them before, during, or after the meal? What's the difference between a digestive enzyme and a pancreatic enzyme, for example?
So enzymes... you know, lactase is an enzyme, so we use that for lactose intolerance. Beano is an enzyme that's used to help digest beans. So the term enzyme is basically a protein that helps digestion or helps to break down something. That's an enzyme, or to facilitate a chemical reaction. But when it comes to digestive enzymes, there's over-the-counter and then there's prescription variations. And in general, the prescription are stronger, higher concentration, and higher purity. And that's why, you know, people tend to see a better response to the prescription. But the natural enzymes you can buy in store, they have those enzymes in them, and they may be enough for some people, and you don't require a prescription per se. But basically, the premise of enzymes, if you want to just treat SIBO, for example, let's say they don't have an atrophic pancreas like in my last comment, but they just have, you know, some relative deficiency or they want to treat their SIBO. Basically, what we're doing is we're not doing Vivanex, that's or elemental diet because that's elemental. But what we are hoping is that the enzymes can break food down faster, more for you, less for the bacteria, and help prevent feed them. Now, it doesn't mean you gain weight because eventually those calories the bacteria are eating go to you anyway because when they die, they release their chemicals, you get them. So it's not that you're absorbing more, therefore gaining more weight. It's therefore you're absorbing them faster than the bacteria can. Therefore, you're getting the calories and they're not initially, and so you get less bloating. So let's say if I were to take a SIBO patient, never treated them with anything, put them on pancreatic enzymes, I would get probably 20 or 30% improvement in symptoms with enzymes alone. That's what we used to see in some of the refractory patients back in the day when we didn't have rifaximin. And we would get some response, but we couldn't get 80 or 90% improvement.
Well, some of us would take 20% of an improvement for sure.
No
right?
question. Yes. And we do use that for some of the toughest cases even now.
So what usually comes up when we start talking about enzymes is HCL. Apple cider vinegar, do PPI, proton pump inhibitors, cause SIBO or create an environment for SIBO to either be worse or to actually start?
I love this topic because it's never what you think and it's always more complicated than you think. So there are patients who come to my clinic wanting to go on HCL or betaine HCL or they're convinced the PPI is the cause. So let's take it in two bites. Acid in the stomach kills bacteria because if you eat an apple or take a bite of an apple, that apple's covered with bacteria. You can't help, you know, putting bacteria in your mouth. So the acid is one protective mechanism for preventing bacterial buildup. But it's a different type of overgrowth we're talking about. We're talking about oral bacteria, gram-positive bacteria. it's a different level of overgrowth. The other part that confuses people is that in IBS, we don't see more SIBO in PPI users. Remember, how much acid do you need to kill bacteria? How many minutes of acid exposure? If you were to pour hydrochloric acid on a bacteria sitting on my desk right now, I guarantee you within a minute that bacteria is dead. So even on a PPI, you probably have half an hour of acid breakthrough in a 24-hour period. And you've just wiped out the bacteria in that upper gut from that little bit of acid for that short period of time. So we don't think PPI is as big a deal as it could be. Now, on the flip side, let's talk about HCl, betaine HCl. So HCl, if you add more acid, could you kill bacteria? Well, I can tell you that if you took the amount of acid that the stomach produces in a drink, you would rip your esophagus apart because the stomach produces massive quantities of acid. And so taking small amounts, I doubt, is going to be all that useful. However, after saying that, what we know is that acid is a hydrogen source. And methanogens, methane bacteria, use hydrogen sources to produce methane. So if you're a methane producer and you add more and more acid to your gut, you're going to make more and more methane. So if you don't know what type of overgrowth person you are, you're going to get more methane production by taking HCl. So that's really a contraindication to taking HCl. Now going back to PPI, we noticed that people who were on a PPI had less methane. It was statistically less. So maybe PPI is good for overgrowth if it's methane and bad for overgrowth if it's not. So as I said in the beginning, it's a very interesting question, very complicated, and it could be bad, it could be good.
Okay, so
did I just confuse you all, or was that somewhat clear?
So if I'm on a PPI, it's not like top priority necessarily to get off of it necessarily.
That's correct. I don't take people off PPI if you have overgrowth. If you have methane overgrowth, I definitely don't take you off the PPI because you actually are reducing the methane fuel because you have less acid going through the gut.
Wow. All right, we're going to keep going here. This has something to do with diets and treatment. So per your theory, the patients with SIBO should not have any diet restrictions when they're going through the antibiotic treatment to avoid the bacteria from hibernating or encapsulating. So that's one thing, if you want to comment on that. But then also, interestingly, why then when we are instructed to have a very restrictive diet for the breath tests, does that make sense?
Let me give you an example. If I were to eat beans as part of my dinner, not as the full dinner, beans can take and linger in the gastrointestinal tract. They will inhibit the migrating motor complex because they're a complex carbohydrate and they bind to the receptors that tell you you're still eating, you're still eating, you're still eating, you're still eating, because they take almost 24 hours later, there's still bean residue in the small intestine. So if there's bean residue in the small intestine still, your hydrogen level on a breath test, whether you're a normal human or a SIBO person, is going to be too high to start. That's the extreme end of it. But we put people on a somewhat restrictive diet so that we make sure that that hydrogen is at its lowest level. Hibernation occurs if you're on restriction for a prolonged period of time, because the gut bacteria expect that you're fasting and eating. That's what normal humans do. We sleep at night. It doesn't mean the bacteria are becoming spores at night. They're resting. But if you fast for a week or for 10 days in terms of on a relative fast, meaning you're on a restricted diet. But if you fast for a real long time, like elemental diet, then the bacteria usually die between days 10 and 14. That's what we figured out was the best fasting time. They can't live longer. Yeah, they may form spores, but those will be passed out into the bowel. Spores can't hang on to the intestine with like hairs or you know the adherence molecules. They tend to be shed. I don't know if I'm answering the question, but basically, fasting for a day doesn't do anything. to affect the breath test negatively. It's actually good for the breath test to start at a lower number.
Okay. That does answer the question. And then basically beans are not happening anymore.
No bueno.
No bueno. No,
they're not good. I mean, beans are the top of our list of do not eat if you have SIBO. Beans, lentils, legumes, they're at the top of the list.
Even if you do like a beanzyme enzyme, it's just not strong enough.
So even with lactase enzyme, we know that it does break down lactose, but the reason there's lactate milk is because the pills never worked good enough. And as soon as those enzymes hit acid in the stomach, they degrade already. So, you know, probably 70% of a lactate pill is broken down before the enzyme even has a chance to work. So it's never going to be as good as lactose-free milk.
Got it. So this next little group of questions has to do with methanogens or methane dominant, which is constipation dominant, SIBO. Have you worked at all with Atrantil or had any experience with it or comfortable commenting on that?
So Atrantil is being used fairly commonly in patients with methane and to some effect. I don't use it all that often because we have such good success with what we're doing, but I have seen patients who've taken it and had some success in the methane side.
How long does it take for methanogens to actually produce methane gas?
So this is why the breath test is different for methane in part. So when we do breath testing for methane, you don't need to have lactulose. The methane is there right from the get-go because to get to methane, you have to have a sugar. The sugar has to interact with the hydrogen-producing bacteria. The hydrogen-producing bacteria have to produce hydrogen, and that takes about 90 minutes, 60 to 90 minutes. And then once the hydrogen is produced, the hydrogen goes into the methane bug. And then they produce methane 60 to 90 minutes later from the hydrogen. So you're not going to see a rise in methane for hours and hours and hours after lactulose. So we don't look for a rise of methane. We look for is it there or not in an abnormal quantity. That's how we determine methane.
Okay. I think you've been talking about how methane is actually a different disease than SIBO. Am I getting too close to the stuff you're going to be revealing in at DDW?
No, I've said this in lectures already, that methane, we number one, in methane or in constipation, because methane is attributed to constipation and methane actually causes the constipation, that in the constipation side of this disease, otherwise known as methane, the anti-vinculin, anti-CDTB antibodies are almost never present, so you don't see them there. So we don't think food poisoning, per se, is a definitive trigger for the constipation side. Again, supporting that a bloom, for reasons that we don't know or why, happens in these methane people. And so again, we don't know why, but the good news about methane is that there are a number of treatments available and some treatments coming down the pipeline that could really eliminate methane altogether. And that could be something that could be cured in the next couple of years.
Very exciting. What if methane and hydrogen are both positive with constipation? Is that still SIBO or could it be something else?
So the thing about methane is you need hydrogen to produce methane. If you have a lot of hydrogen, you can produce more methane, or that the methane bugs aren't high enough to get rid of all the hydrogen. But what we see is if we get rid of methane, then the hydrogen builds up. Hydrogen building up actually inhibits the hydrogen bacteria, and they start to reduce in number. So getting rid of methane can actually reduce hydrogen bacteria also, because they tend to pickle themselves with all their hydrogen. So it's kind of a two-hit if you get rid of methane.
Okay. So if somebody has a breath test and they have it be high in hydrogen, they take their treatment, they do another breath test, can it still be high in, and it switches, now it's high in methane. Does that make sense?
No, okay. It doesn't. So the reason I say it doesn't make sense is because in 20 years of doing breath tests, I think we can find three instances where somebody converts from only hydrogen producing to methane. Now, we can get rid of methane and see hydrogen go up, but we almost never see the reverse. Like three times in 20 years, we've seen somebody who's predominantly hydrogen switch and become a methane producer after treatment. That almost never happens.
Okay, interesting. Now, can hydrogen lead to leaky, hydrogen SIBO lead to leaky gut more than methane SIBO, or is it just equal opportunity?
I don't know the answer to that question because I don't think anybody's studied that. But in terms of leaky gut, when you have too much bacteria in the digestive tract, there is some attempt to get those out because the cleaning wave is not working. So it's not good to have all that bacteria there. So some of the gaps between cells do open to allow immune system chemicals to come out and see if they can get rid of the bacteria. And that may be why leaky gut occurs in some of these cases. Now, vinculin, as it turns out, isn't just in nerve cells of the gut. It's also in the epithelium. And if you inhibit vinculin, then it's possible that leaky gut could be caused that way as well from the antibodies in the bloodstream, the anti-vinculin.
So if you help to get rid of those antibodies, you're going to help your leaky gut. Theoretically.
Stay tuned, yes.